Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We'll begin today on this September 12th, a little differently from usual, with a historical soundbite. Now, this is something that a Washington Post article today reminded me of, and I won't say too much to set it up because it will really speak for itself about how some people have changed and how our politics have changed since the September 11th attacks that we observed the 17th anniversary of yesterday. So this is 2 minutes of Rudy Giuliani from his farewell address as mayor in December 2001.
I remember after the attack on the World Trade Center, it just came very naturally for me to say to people, do not engage in group blame. Do not go single out people who are Arab Americans and blame the attack on the World Trade Center on them. Because the people who attacked the World Trade Center, we weren't even sure exactly who it was then. But the people who attacked the World Trade Center obviously are vicious criminals of the worst kind. And there isn't a single group that sits out there that doesn't have among them vicious criminals of some kind. Every ethnic group, religious group, racial group has some bad, really bad people in that group. And then the question becomes, are you the kind of prejudiced, irrational human being that defines the group based on the bad people in that group, which means you're going to end up hating everybody? Or do you kind of get beyond that and see that, in fact, in every group, most people are decent people who are just trying to do the same thing that you're doing? I think the experience of New York allows more and more people to see that than any place else, because we keep bumping into each other all the time, and you keep bumping into people who look different than you do. I mean, you see them all over. They have different outfits, and they talk different languages, and they wear different clothes, and they say different things, and that experience, if you're a person of some degree of common sense and intelligence, that experience opens you up to the feeling that, well, people are basically all the same. And it's the greatest strength that we have. The greatest strength that we have as a city is immigration and keeping ourselves open to people. And we shouldn't allow what's happened to us in the last three and a half months. We shouldn't allow what's happened to us to stop that in any way at all. We should continue to be open to people.
Rudy Giuliani, hello, from his farewell address as mayor in December 2001. The text of that excerpt was printed in a Washington Post article by their media critic, Eric Wemple, in relation to something someone said on Fox News. But just as New Yorkers, and with the anniversary still so fresh, I thought you might like to hear that historical audio. Now, of course, Giuliani is all in defending the president who said this to get elected.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Remember the Giuliani words that we just heard? Then the question becomes, are you the kind of prejudiced, irrational human being that defines the group based on the bad people in that group, which means you're going to end up hating everybody? Or do you kind of get beyond that and see that, in fact, in every group, most people are decent people? Didn't Trump just say, I assume some are good people? That most people are decent people who are just trying to do the same thing that you are doing, said Rudy Giuliani in 2001. Let's talk about that and more now with Washington Post columnist Karen Tumulty. Hi, Karen. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
So you tweeted that Eric Wemple article with that Giuliani quote. What were you thinking listening to it?
I was thinking so much yesterday about the anniversary, and it really was a moment that, you know, Rudy Giuliani in many ways came to symbolize that moment. And yesterday, President Trump seemed to sort of remember it completely differently. He described Rudy Giuliani as having been a true warrior on that day. I think most people remember Rudy Giuliani as being somebody who both sort of consoled the country and calmed it down, that he actually was a unifier on that day, less than he was a warrior. And he was also reminding people that of the resilience of New York City. He promised we're going to rebuild and we're going to be stronger than we were before. Now, you know, of course, a lot of people look at Rudy Giuliani today and say, where did that guy go? But that really was, I think, the enduring image of Rudy Giuliani on that day.
And it was that kind of calm, as you wrote, and unifying calm and reassuring unifying calm on 9/11 and in the weeks after 9/11 that got Rudy Giuliani named Time Magazine's Person of the Year for 2001 out of anybody they might have picked that year.
It was. He did become, I think, the people were referring to him as America's mayor. You know, ironically enough, too, 9/11 happened on the day of the New York primaries. It was the day that the city was going to select Rudy Giuliani's successor. It was sort of the beginning of his march into irrelevancy. And again, he did become, whatever people think of him now, however people might go back and say this was done right or this was done wrong. I mean, in that moment, he was seen as a great force for unity, not division.
Karen Tumulty, Washington Post political columnist, my guest on WNYC. We're going to get to all kinds of things as we go that are in the news today. But listeners, if you have any thoughts after hearing that historical audio of Giuliani's farewell address, you can call in with those, as well as anything else you want to say or ask about national politics at this moment. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And for that matter, about New York at this moment, because Karen, you're a Washington Post columnist based in Washington, but one thing that strikes me from that clip from Giuliani is that he has changed more than New York has changed. The other part of that, besides what he was like, was that he said, reading from the text of that clip, I think the experience of New York allows more and more people to see that, the unity, the reasons not to be prejudiced, than any place else, because we keep bumping into each other all the time, and you keep bumping into people who look different than you do. I mean, you see them all over. They have different outfits, and they talk different languages. And he went on, if you're a person of some degree of common sense and intelligence, that experience opens you up to feeling that, well, people are basically all the same, and that's the great strength that we have as a city, immigration. And the politics of New York have not gone with the politics of Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump. I think that's a very striking thing to note on the day after the 17th anniversary of 9/11. Karen, I wonder if you have any thoughts about that where you sit.
Well, I also found myself thinking about President Trump because, in my opinion, his finest moment as a presidential candidate came in the sixth Republican debate of the primary season when Ted Cruz hit him with a line that Ted Cruz had started using on the campaign trail, which was he attacked Donald Trump for having quote-unquote New York values. And at that moment, the future president said he talked about 9/11 and the smell of death that had pervaded the city. And he said, I saw something that no place on earth could have handled more beautiful, more humanely than New York. Again, very much of a contrast from the Donald Trump that we see today in the White House.
So let's move on. There are polls out this week that show Trump at new lows. And yet the anti-Muslim and anti-Mexican things he uses politically have been winners for him. Those have not dragged him down. They didn't drag him down even as explicit as they were during the campaign, low enough to lose the campaign. People were able to see Hillary Clinton as worse than that bigotry somehow. But suddenly, Trump is sinking to new lows. He's in the mid-30s overall in approval ratings, and he's being rated by large majorities as not truthful. And independents dropped 16 points in the CNN poll in 1 month, down from mid-40s to the low 30s. That is a mind-blowing drop. I see the Washington Post has an article today about how suddenly Republicans are worried about losing the Senate, which mathematically was supposed to be safer than the House. What's going on?
Well, you know, and the first poll was the Washington Post poll that came out about a week and a half ago that had President Trump's approval down in the, I think it was around 38%, but importantly, his disapproval hitting its highest level ever at 60. And it was unclear whether the Post poll at that point was an outlier. These subsequent polls are showing that no, indeed, it wasn't. And I think what's unique about Donald Trump and his political strategy is that, you know, this is a man who came to office having lost the popular vote. Most presidents in office try to sort of expand their reach, kind of reach out to people who didn't necessarily support them and bring them into the tent. Donald Trump has really done the opposite. He has sort of drilled down on his hardcore supporters, those people who he said would support him if he went out on Fifth Avenue and shot someone, and really focused on revving up that base of hardcore Donald Trump supporters. Whether this is going to be able to help the Republicans in the midterm election, I think that's an increasingly dubious proposition, even though the important thing to remember about the midterms, which is what people forgot about the presidential election, which is this is an election that is fought out sort of hand-to-hand combat, state by state, congressional district by congressional district.
What are the implications of Democrats taking the House, or for that matter, taking both the House and the Senate? Since that's a new piece of the conversation, let's focus on that. What happens, what potentially happens, if all of a sudden Trump is still president, but the Democrats have control, let's say a slim majority of both houses of Congress?
Well, what will certainly happen, even if Democrats get control of one house of Congress, will be that Trump's legislative agenda will come to a screeching halt. And also, you will have a new set of committee chairmen, and those committee chairmen and women will have subpoena power. And so what we will see is, you know, an intelligence committee that is being run by Adam Schiff and not Devin Nunes is going to take a very different footing toward the Russia investigation. You will see all of that happen. The question, the sort of nuclear scenario for President Trump, and the one, by the way, that he himself is mentioning more and more lately, is that if both houses of Congress get in the hands of the Democrats, that potentially impeachment could be on the table. I think that is still quite a bit of a leap. First of all, we have no idea yet what special counsel Robert Mueller is going to come up with. But also, it's important to remember that if, in fact, say, Democrats regain control of the House, and assuming it's relatively narrow control, the people who are going to make that majority for them will be, yes, some diehard people from the Democratic liberal base, but also a lot of people who have won back districts that were held by Republicans, people like Connor Lamb. These are not going to be, you know, if they want to get reelected, kind of flaming liberal, you know, scorched earth kinds of legislators.
Even at the same time that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez presumably will be entering Congress, and others in that wing of the party.
That's true. That's true. But again, hers is a seat that, assuming she gets elected, which we certainly should at this point, hers is a seat that would have been Democratic one way or another. If, in fact, the Democrats want to protect that majority, if they want to protect those seats that they have won back from the Republicans, I think they are going to have to be concerned that they are not forcing these people in relatively moderate districts to take a lot of votes that are going to come back and kill them in 2020 and potentially could help Donald Trump in 2020.
I get what you're saying about investigations, whether or not they try to actually impeach Trump, as you say, would depend on what the Mueller investigation ultimately finds with respect to Trump himself. And you need 67 votes in the Senate, two-thirds of the Senate. The Democrats are going to have nothing near that. So whatever Trump is found to have done, if anything, would have to be so bad that he would lose 15 or so Republicans who would feel that they need to vote for his removal at the very least. And so, you know, that's a very unlikely outcome under almost any scenario of what we know of that Mueller is looking at, though that could change. There would then be investigations, again, as you were indicating, and we think about the Republican Congress when Barack Obama was president, and they kept investigating Hillary Clinton and Benghazi. They kept investigating Eric Holder and some alleged scandals attached to him. They kept investigating the IRS and some alleged scandals attached to that. We might see a similar thing from the Democratic Congress, which might be legitimate investigations or might just be acts of politics. But I'm also curious, Karen, if control of Congress changes, much more important in my opinion, does it affect the Trump agenda? Immigration, environmental regulation, any of it, or just investigations into Trump world?
Well, there is a lot that a president can do with executive authority, with executive orders. We certainly saw that under President Obama, and we also have seen it under President Trump. So a lot of this kind of rolling back of regulation presumably would stay in place to be reversed only by a president with a different outlook in this. But on the legislative aspects of his agenda, again, a lot of immigration and things like tax policy and spending policy, yes, the Democrats will have the power not necessarily to enact their own agenda, because it is, again, looking at the numbers, hard to imagine veto-proof majorities here, but to bring President Trump's agenda to a screeching halt.
And I wonder, before we move on and take some phone calls, how you think any of this is affecting the Brett Kavanaugh nomination if suddenly there is the perception that Trump is more unpopular than members of the Senate thought he was a month ago. And of course, you know, the polls, we should never overestimate the importance of the polls, because polls change with the headlines. And Trump has had some really bad headlines that we can reference if we need to over the past month. So he's had a really bad month. So this just could be part of the ups and downs of approval ratings of being president of the United States, or it could be the beginning of a longer term movement in one direction. But for the moment, we have the Brett Kavanaugh nomination about to go to a vote, and I see Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski are under increasing pressure. What can you tell us about that and how it relates to Trump's cratering for the moment approval?
Well, at this point, the Senate confirmation, the vote by the full Senate on Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation is expected to come the week of September 24th. Yes, we've seen a couple of moderates under a lot of pressure on this vote. But going into this election, the people who are under real pressure potentially are Democrats who are running in states that President Trump won, and in some case won handily. Their prospects are looking a little better now. One of the great, you know, surprise stories is you have Senator Joe Manchin looking increasingly safe in West Virginia, a state that President Trump won by something like 40 percentage points. But these Democratic senators in red states are also going to be under a lot of pressure. If I had to bet, I would bet Brett Kavanaugh's nomination goes through, and goes through pretty smoothly.
Let's take a phone call for Karen Tumulty, national politics columnist for The Washington Post, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Karen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Karen.
Hello. I just wanted to go back to a comment about Rudolph Giuliani. And I think everybody is suffering from mass amnesia, because he was to New York exactly what Donald Trump is to the country. He was mean, divisive, and vindictive. So I don't know who wrote his speech for 9/11, but it was a performance. It was not who the man was, and it was not what he did with New York City.
Karen, thank you very much. And maybe there were just different sides of Rudy Giuliani that came out at different times. But Karen Tumulty, certainly as Karen from Brooklyn reminds us, Rudy Giuliani as mayor was extremely racially divisive. He wasn't anti-immigration, which is more how we think of Trump, but in black-white terms, he was extremely racially divisive. He certainly was vindictive in various ways, as the caller says. So Rudy Giuliani had a mixed legacy. And you know, on September 10th, 2001, his popularity had really plummeted in New York. And because he seemed so high-minded and reassuring and unifying on September 11th, September 12th, and the weeks after that, his popularity soared again, both nationally as well as at home, in the city. But on September 10th, he was not a popular guy, and he was seen as a divider, not a uniter, in terms of local politics.
And again, September 11th, as I mentioned before, was primary day. That was the day that essentially, you know, people were expecting that history would be showing Rudy Giuliani the door. Instead, what we saw was, and this is something that people don't really necessarily remember either, he went into the 2004 presidential primary season as the front runner for the Republican nomination for president. It turned out that Rudy Giuliani was a little bit more of a difficult sell in places like Iowa and New Hampshire than he thought he would be. But it did sort of change his career trajectory there for a while.
Rena in Somerset, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rena.
Hi, Brian. My question to your expert is that, one, if there is going to be a Democratic Senate, hopefully, and also in the Congress, whether one, they could enact a law which would make it a requirement for all presidential contenders to release their tax returns, and, so that this would force whoever is going to be the next president or wants to be a president has to show their tax returns. And the other would be the tax laws that were passed. Is it possible to reverse some of them? Because, you know, the deficit is going to balloon out of proportion. So I was wondering if that's a possibility.
Rena, thank you. Karen?
And could I first of all correct something I just said? I said that Rudy Giuliani ran for president in 2004. That was 2008. But I think those are all terrific points, and especially this idea that Donald Trump has been so lacking in transparency, not only in his tax returns but in his business dealings. And with the death a few weeks ago of Senator John McCain, I think we've heard a lot of talk, not just among Democrats but also Republicans, about the need to kind of change some of the laws here so that candidates do, in fact, have to put forward their finances and let us see what's really going on there. That was something Senator McCain was very big on. And as far as the deficit goes, it is extraordinary that, you know, the Republican Party is sort of sitting there as spectators and in fact enacting a lot of policies that are going to balloon the deficit. The same people who complained about trillion-dollar deficits under Barack Obama are doing it now themselves. Only President Obama's, that was during economic hard times. What's very different now is to see the deficit growing like this when the economy is strong. And I think that is a pretty much of an unprecedented situation.
The Post also has an article today. That's the Washington Post, where my guest Karen Tumulty works. The Post has an article today about Paul Manafort in talks regarding a plea deal. What's the latest?
Well, we don't know where these talks are going to go, but Paul Manafort has already been convicted in his first trial in Virginia in front of that's an area that's known for its conservative juries. it was almost, except for the vote of one juror, apparently it would have been a pretty clean win for Bob Mueller. Even the charges that he was convicted on would be enough to put him in prison for the rest of his natural life. So we do, it's maybe not surprising that he's going into a second trial now in the District of Columbia, where you tend to get more liberal juries, that he might be wanting to look at some kind of plea deal. The other thing that struck me as I was reading that story is if he is in plea negotiations, it may be that he is not counting on a pardon from President Trump.
And the second Manafort trial is much more related to Russia and policy than the first convictions were on tax and bank fraud charges, right? If Manafort, if I'm remembering correctly, Manafort is accused in these cases of concealing that he was an agent for a foreign government or foreign actors, the pro-Russia Ukrainians, while he was Trump's campaign manager. And that doesn't make Trump a conspirator with Russia to hack Democratic emails necessarily, but it brings the whole conversation a lot closer to what was Trump's campaign manager doing with Russia and concealing from the government and from the American people at the time he was Trump's campaign manager. And then what else were he and Trump doing in collusion with Russia? So this trial gets much more interesting if it goes forward, right?
That is correct. And the other thing that is interesting about this trial is the prosecutors have already signaled with the number of exhibits that they are bringing to this trial that they are going to be coming armed with more than twice as much evidence as they had in the first trial. And again, you are correct. This could actually get, unlike the first trial, this could actually get to the question of his actions while he was the campaign chairman of the 2016 Trump campaign.
I want to take a caller who's calling in to push back on some of how we're characterizing or reacting to the Rudy Giuliani clip from 2001. Bill in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Bill, thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian. My name is Bill McGowan. I've actually been on your show in the past. I'm a journalist and an author. I was a 9/11 first responder. I went in as a medical volunteer, not a journalist, but I did write about it 5 years later for Newsweek. Mm-hmm. I was on the border recently in the Texas-Mexican border, and this speaks to the question of Karen's characterization of the mood of tolerance and unity that Giuliani propagated afterward, after 9/11. And, you know, I just wonder whether, you know, kind of singing the Kumbaya song shouldn't, kind of take precedence over kind of concerns for our vigilance. Down in Texas, they're greatly concerned with the gaining numbers of special interest aliens who are not coming from Central America or Mexico, but are coming from Pakistan, Bangladesh, Democratic Republic of Congo, all these places that are in political and economic meltdown. And they're kind of concerns are getting kind of subsumed in the larger debate about asylum, the asylum process, family separation. And I just wonder if we might sort of pause and just remember that we're 17 years out. 9/11 kind of exposed a lot of lapses in national security and intelligence sharing, but also holes and weaknesses in the immigration system that the terrorists took advantage of. And they were masterful at taking advantage of those. So I wonder whether we might just think about fool me once, fool me twice, and kind of, you know, get a little bit more rigorous about this border debate and a little bit more rigorous about the immigration debate. So,
Karen?
And correct me if I'm wrong, though. As I recall, at least, the hijackers were primarily people, the ones who were here illegally, because they had overstayed visas,
They got automatic visas. A lot of them got automatic visas in Saudi Arabia. Yes, they did overstay, but there was an awful lot of, kind of where local police departments, some of these guys had driving DWIs that never got reported up the chain, in effect, kind of operating as if the places where they were popped, for these traffic infractions and minor crimes, were kind of sanctuary cities. There was no information sharing and law enforcement on the domestic side.
Right. But the problem, I think, Bill, and there are problems on, various points on the political spectrum on this, is that the Rudy Giuliani of 2001, who was saying the question becomes, are you the kind of prejudiced, irrational human being that defines the group based on the bad people in that group? He would still have said what you said, I'm sure. We have to look at the holes in the immigration system that let those individuals who staged the 9/11 attacks with that intent to fall through the cracks. It's so much different than Trump proposing a total and complete Muslim ban to the United States, or building a wall and calling Mexicans as a group rapists and murderers and drug dealers.
I totally agree with you on that, but you also have to realize Giuliani was responding to a perceived possible breakdown in civic order, and where you might have had people going into Arab neighborhoods out in Atlantic Avenue,
right,
and other places, and really exacting a toll.
And Trump is practically encouraging. I'm not saying he's saying go into any neighborhood and commit acts of violence. But he almost does encourage acts of violence in some other contexts. But by the same token, Bill, I think the Democrats have lost. The Democrats have lost the plot in terms of only pushing back against Trump's excesses and bigotry, and not saying much at all about genuine border security and genuine closing of these potential terrorism risk loopholes. And so the whole thing has become ridiculous.
Well, the thing is, there's so much fraud in the asylum seeking process. I mean, that they estimates are upwards of 75% to 80% of people who really don't have a legitimate claim. And this is just emboldening people from non-American countries, meaning not Mexican, not Central American, to be able to sort of wave this flag. I mean, reports about the number of Bangladeshis who are just materializing at the border, and the first word out of their mouth is fear, so they can get a credible fear interview. So, I'm just raising this as an issue that we should not lose sight. When we talk about tolerance, diversity, unity, etc., let's not lose sight that what happened on 9/11 happened because of major systems failures, but also a kind of laxity and a lack of rigor in our political and media culture that needed a wake up, to get smacked up on the head. And shame on us if we lose that vigilance.
Bill, thank you for your call. I really appreciate it. And Karen Tumblety, before you go, yesterday was the day that the Bob Woodward book actually came out. He's been doing the rounds now. In fact, he's going to be on our midday show coming up at noon today, right here on WNYC. Is it making a difference to anything in any way, or is it all about just gossip?
Well, I tell you, the Trump presidency has almost become a coloring book. The outlines are very clear, and all the reports we get sort of just, shade in between the lines. Bob Woodward's book is very much the Trump White House is disputing the details, but Bob Woodward has an amazing track record, and his book is very, very consistent with the general thrust of a lot of other books and a lot of other reportings that come out about this administration day after day after day.
Karen Tumblety, national politics columnist for The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Great to be here.